60 Minutes, coming up next.
So I was recently looking to buy a new car, and I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. And that's when a friend of mine told me about this new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car that you're looking at in your area, so you know if you're getting a good price. Because here's what happens. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer. You can't beat it. Save time, save money, never overpay. If you're going to buy a car, go to TrueCar.com today.
This looks like an arena concert, but it's a private party for the super rich. The Robin Hood Foundation's annual fundraiser seats 4,000.
Brothers and sisters of Robin Hood.
Billionaires, stars, and athletes are here to lay credit cards at the feet of Paul Tudor Jones.
The risk is not doing this.
So what is this modern-day Robin Hood doing with all this money? That's our story tonight.
A 7.1 earthquake hit the San Francisco-Oakland area on
October 17, 1989.
When we first did this story, there were only six people known to have this remarkable memory ability in the world. There are now close to 60, including Jake.
I just have that type of memory that can remember everything.
A 10-year-old.
What happened in school on January 30th, 2013?
I'm pretty sure... Oh, wait. That's a trick question. We didn't have school that day.
On this Easter Sunday, we're going to bring you to one of the poorest places on Earth. But you won't feel pity for any of our characters, only joy. Because while the members of this orchestra in the Congo don't have many possessions, they enjoy their music more than any group we've ever met.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes. Ask Wall Street bankers the net worth of Paul Tudor Jones, and they'll tell you $4.3 billion. He's one of those hedge fund managers. But ask a homeless child or a struggling family, and they'll tell you that a spreadsheet is no way to measure a man. Paul Tudor Jones wonders that if billionaires like him are such geniuses, then why do nearly 2 million people live in poverty in New York City alone? In 1988, he started a charity called the Robin Hood Foundation. Now, more than 25 years later, Robin Hood has given away nearly $1.5 billion. As we first showed you last May, it's become the city's largest private backer of charter schools, job training, and food programs. Tudor Jones has learned hard lessons for a latter-day Robin Hood. Turns out, giving to the poor is harder than he thought. And as for taking from the rich, well, he finds it's best to distract them. This looks like an arena concert, but it's a private party for the super rich. The Robin Hood Foundation's annual fundraiser seats 4,000 in Manhattan's Convention Center.
It's amazing who is here tonight. Give yourselves a round of applause. It's like the 1% has its own 1%.
They laugh because it's true. Billionaires, stars, and athletes are here for the 22nd year to lay credit cards at the feet of Paul Tudor Jones.
Brothers and sisters of Robin Hood, new ideas, different ideas, crazy ideas, though, those are the ones that change the world. And boy, does the world outside these walls need changing.
What do you see when you look around the city?
I see people in pain, people in need, people at times without hope, looking for something that will give them some compelling future. I see
too many people in homeless shelters, on food stamps. I think a lot of us don't like to focus on it, but it's a significant part of this country that needs to be addressed.
There was a time he was focused on himself.
It's 40 minutes and a half.
This is Paul Tudor Jones in the 1980s, age 32, in a documentary about Wall Street.
Tell me more behind it. Do it, do it, do it. There's more behind it.
My mother told me I was going to be a preacher. I always wanted to be a millionaire or a movie director.
So you chose millionaire?
I don't know if I chose millionaire. I ultimately got to that point, yes.
That point and far beyond. But his mother had seen something of a preacher, and months after that documentary, Tudor Jones caught a glimpse of it too. It was 1986, one Sunday night.
Millionaire with Heart of Gold offers hope to ghetto kids.
Harry Reasoner met Gene Lang, a millionaire who guaranteed college tuition for every kid in one Harlem class.
Are they good kids? You like them?
Oh, I love them. I mean, I look them now at them now, all of them, as an extension of my family.
Well, the second that program finished, I picked up the phone, I called Gene Lang, and I said, I want to do what you're doing.
You know, I'm curious what it was about that program and about where you were in your life that ignited that spark in that moment.
There was probably a hole in my soul, and I didn't really know it at the time. And all of a sudden, here was this man that showed the joy of giving. So the lesson that I learned was that there was a whole new journey in my life that was ahead of me that I had not yet even realized was there.
So he adopted a school too, confident that if he showered it with money, the students would thrive.
I was throwing everything in the world I could at it. I was taking them on trips every summer and providing after-school services. We put so much time, energy, and love into them.
But he failed. After 5 years, the grades in his school were no better than average.
I felt like I had failed a great deal of those kids. But failure, a lot of times, is the fire that forges the steel for success, right? There are going to be stops, there are going to be failures, there are going to be setbacks, but you grow from those and you get better and it becomes transformative.
Turned out a preacher's compassion needed a little Wall Street ruthlessness. So Tudor Jones and his friends set up Robin Hood to invest in poverty programs in the same hard-nosed way that they invested in business. Their offices are filled with analysts and accountants who help the best ideas develop and measure the results without mercy.
My relationship with Robin Hood has evolved over the years, like mother-daughter, you know, friend and foe.
Sister Mary Alice Hannon's soup kitchen in the Bronx had lived hand-to-mouth for almost a decade, and then came Robin Hood with an offer to invest and expand.
Friend and foe.
Friend and foe. I mean this in a loving way, but I loved and hated them in 30 seconds. And I'm sure they felt the same way about me.
Love was nice, but Robin Hood wanted data. Who was being served? How many? What was the cost? Did the data support expansion? And where was the nun's business plan?
So I'm like, okay.
You're just trying to get through today.
Today, right. So the first thing was a 5-year strategic plan. I went, oh, all right. And it was a long, tedious experience, and it was wonderful. And we came up with all these spectacular goals, and that was really, really good. Yay, yay. It was the follow-up of the goals that became the challenge.
We started asking grantees, what are your goals? And then holding them accountable. And yet, at the same time, providing management expertise and providing administrative help and legal help and help to secure buildings. So we weren't just holding them accountable. We were helping them along the way.
I need two on table 9, please.
Robin Hood invested $5 million in the kitchen's expansion goals, and now they're serving more than twice as many as before. But when programs don't perform, Robin Hood takes the money back.
Every year we probably defund 5 to 10% of our grantees. Not because of the fact that they're not wonderful, not because of the fact that they're not trying real hard, but because we're not getting results.
You do that to 5 to 10% of your projects every year?
Yes, because we're always trying to find new things. And by definition, you're gonna fail at times. It's what you have to do to be at the forefront of actually finding a way to kick poverty's ass.
Recently, Robin Hood's board of directors met at the soup kitchen. The personal net worth of the board adds up to $25 billion. Robinhood takes all of its expenses from the board members, so 100% of donations are given to the poor, just like its namesake.
If you said to me what part of our success is due to our name, I'd say it's a big part of it, because it's a great name, right? It says everything. Robinhood did it.
Is that what happens at that gala we went to, taking from the rich?
Well,
you put the arm on them.
But many years from now, when you look back on your life, and you're at your end, would you trade those fleeting luxuries for one chance, just one chance, to return to this night and to give 100,000 people a chance to grab their dream?
You were shaking people by their ankles.
Well, you cannot have significance in this life if it's all about you. You get your significance, you find your joy in life, through service and sacrifice. It's pure and simple.
Big charity galas often bring in $3 or $5 million. Tudor Jones took in more than $57 million this night. The money goes to about 500 projects. Robin Hood spent $126 million last year with a heavy emphasis on schools.
You are graduating your first class.
Hallelujah.
Good morning, sir. Jabali Sawicki is headmaster of what was a crack house, an old school in Brooklyn that had been abandoned as the neighborhood collapsed.
It's dilapidated. It's falling down. People walk by and they graffiti on it. That's exactly how people view African-American boys at the time.
How you doing, sir?
Sawicki was hired by Tudor Jones.
I hope that you...
And they opened the Excellence Boys Charter School, grades K through 8. Tudor Jones believes that his experiment with that middle school in the 1980s failed because he caught the kids too late.
The only way to break the cycle of poverty, statistically, is higher levels of education attract higher levels of income. The only way to beat poverty in America is to completely, totally transform our public education system. It's the only way.
Now, Robin Hood is supporting younger kids in 98 schools. It spent $35 million turning the crack house into a crack program. They call students here scholars. The day is long, and they don't waste a minute.
The square root of 49.
Not even when they're passing from one class to the next.
I multiply by 5. I divide by 2. What's my answer? Omari.
250.
250 is the correct, Daniels.
New York City's Department of Education tells us the Excellence Boys School is significantly better than average in math and science, and slightly better in English.
Oh, what's evil?
The boys have reached the city's top 20%, even though some of them start the day in homeless shelters and others in troubled homes.
There was a shooting near the school recently. How did the boys handle that?
Tragic event. The father of one of our scholars was murdered one block away. And to make matters even worse, two of our other scholars in the school witnessed the entire thing.
What did you tell the boys?
That in 15 to 20 years, they're going to be the men that are out on the street navigating that world. Excellence symbolizes the greatest mechanism for us to create a world where no one ever has to see their father buried, where no one ever has to walk up to the casket, look into that father's closed eyes, and ask mommy, is he sleeping? And we told them, that's why we do this.
Please welcome Mr. Paul Tudor Jones.
This is the graduation of the first class to go from kindergarten through the eighth grade.
I want to congratulate you because...
Some of them are headed to top prep schools.
When you're standing up there, looking across all those faces, what are you going to see?
I'm going to see, first and foremost, men of character.
After that failure with the older kids, Tudor Jones is focused now on the starting line.
Today, we're going to blow this. The race starts after you leave this room today. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
I can't hear you. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Ready, set.
All right, so these are big
Thank you so much for everything.
You got me so proud.
I am proud.
Man, you got it.
After 26 years of Robin Hood,
y'all were fantastic.
Countless lives have been changed, but the city's poverty rate doesn't. It's about 20% year in and year out. If Robin Hood is a hedge fund for humanity, then a Wall Street trader would say that Tudor Jones is buying on the futures market, a bet that investing in young children and families today will pay big dividends in the next generation.
I don't think there's ever actually a point where you can say I won. It's a constant battle. I could see myself with the coffin lid dropping and me still knocking on the top of it, trying to get out, because I think there'll still be a war to fight.
And more to do.
After our story aired the first time, Robin Hood held another gala. The take this time, almost $81 million.
You may or may not recall that a few years back, we brought you a story about a handful of people with memories that are almost unimaginable. Name virtually any date in their lives, and they can tell you what they were doing that day, the day of the week, sometimes even the weather, all within seconds. It's a kind of memory that's brand new to science, literally unheard of just a decade ago. After our original story aired, the scientists studying this phenomenon were flooded with calls and emails. We were so intrigued, we decided to follow the research to see what further study might reveal about these remarkable memories and what it may mean for the rest of us. As we reported earlier this year, they now have many more subjects, including a 10-year-old boy.
Okay, do it.
But first, meet or refresh your memory of our original memory wizards.
A 7.1 earthquake hit the San Francisco-Oakland area on
October 17, 1989.
Tuesday.
We were watching the game of the World Series.
And when were the Oscars held? In 1999.
In 1999, Sunday, March 21st.
Yes.
They remember what they did.
I went to a fabulous Oscar party that day.
What they care about.
When was the last time the Redskins beat the Steelers?
In 91. November 17th, 1991.
Sometimes even the shoes they wore.
These I wore on April the 21st of this year, so that was a Tuesday. Oh, these shoes I got a long time ago.
It's the way most of us remember yesterday.
First time I wore them and I got them was on April the 9th, so that was a Friday of 1982.
This is a detective story.
The scientist who first identified this condition and has been studying it ever since is Dr. James McGaw at the University of California, Irvine. An eye condition requires him to wear a clouded lens.
We are pretending that we are Sherlock Holmes. We've arrived on the scene of a crime or something that's unusual. All of a sudden, we have a new phenomenon of memory, and we're trying to figure out how it is that this happened.
When we did our first story, only 6 people in the world had been identified with this ability, one of them by chance, the actress Mary Lou Henner. But that number changed quickly.
Okay, quiz. What's the date that story first aired?
December 19th, 2010.
What day of the week was it?
Sunday.
Joey DeGrandis, Bill Brown, Tracy Fersan, and Jared Hurd are among the 50 new subjects.
All right. What happened on June 25th, 2009?
Michael Jackson
and Farrah Fawcett died, too.
Farrah Fawcett that morning.
That's right.
They both died the same day.
And when they think about those days, they actually relive them.
It's not just a question of numbers, dates, and times. It's emotion. And so, you know, when we wake up on that certain day of the year, it's kind of like how everybody wakes up feeling on 9/11.
Do you even know that when I think of something 5 years ago, I don't have much emotion attached to it?
I can't even relate to that.
Yeah.
I don't even understand that.
So, Joe, how old were you when you first realized that you could do this?
I was about 10 years old. It was the fall of 94.
It was a Tuesday.
How's it going so far? Are you tricking people?
We had a fourth grade magic show at the very end of the year. It was Thursday, June 1st of 95. And I remember, like, the week before, you know, trying to think of what am I going to do? I'm not a magician. I don't know what I'm going to do for this magic show. My mom said to me, why don't you do your date thing? You know, just blow some calendars up behind you, you know, stand with your back facing the calendars, and when people come by, ask them to pick a date. And that's what I did.
Okay, how about if we pick January 8th, 1993?
Friday.
How about December 15th, 1993? How about February 9th, 1994?
Wednesday again.
Correct.
Until now, Joey's videotape was the closest the researchers had come to seeing this ability in a child. Enter Jake Hausler, age 10.
What day of the week was Halloween 2011?
Monday. That one I didn't even have to think about.
New Year's Day 2010.
Friday. I remember that because I was up all night at the Blues game.
That's when Jake was 6. He lives in St. Louis, loves sports, and is, in most respects, a typical 10-year-old.
What happened related to school on January 30th, 2013?
That day, I'm pretty sure... Oh, wait. That's a trick question. We didn't have school that day. Yeah, there was a huge lightning storm that last night. I'm like, hey, we didn't have school that day.
How's your day, Jake?
Jake's parents, Sari and Eric Hausler, and his older brother, Ben, say they knew something was up with Jake's memory when he was only 3 and he had memorized the inspection stickers on the neighbor's cars. Then he started with the dates.
We'd be driving in the car and we'd be talking about a past event and he would say, oh, that was a Tuesday.
And there was the time the family dog threw up in her crate.
He says to me, well, Mom, tomorrow would be a year since the last time she threw up in her crate.
I remember her first time was Thursday, May 10th, 2012.
I mean, he has a lot of things stuck in his head.
There's a lot in there.
What did you think was going on?
We didn't know.
Not really sure.
They heard about Dr. McGaw's research from our first story and brought Jake out to Irvine for testing. Dr. McGaw says seeing this ability in a child firsthand is significant.
What did you have for breakfast January 1st, 2013?
It was actually pancakes.
My gosh.
We wondered if seeing it this early proves it's innate. Well, take a look at this.
May 27th, 2012. Do you know what day of the week that was?
That was a Sunday.
You're right.
There is exactly one child in the world other than Jake who's been identified so far with this ability, 11-year-old Tyler Hickenbottom. And in a fortuitous coincidence, Tyler happens to be an identical twin. He and his brother Chad share the same genes.
Yeah, I think I might have worn an orange shirt.
But surprisingly not the same memory.
No, that was in 2012 when he had to wear the neon shirt.
Dr. McGaw and his team haven't scanned Chad and Tyler's brains yet to see what secrets they might hold. But they have put Jake into an MRI scanner, as well as many of the adults. The latest findings show a more active pathway between the front and back of the brain.
I would say that the reason that they can do that in part might be because the different parts of the brain have greater access to each other. And so that is exciting, and we're going to have to explore that in more detail.
In the meantime, McGaw and his team have made some surprising new discoveries in their low-tech testing. They showed the memory wizards a short film about a dinner party and later gave them a memory test.
How many coffee mugs were on the kitchen table in the opening scene?
I don't know.
None?
I'm going to guess 4.
The answer is 1.
The surprising thing is they are no better than the rest of us in memory of that film. Now, their explanation for this is that they didn't live that. In other words, they're just watching it. That was not their life.
But even when it comes to their own lives, there have been some unexpected findings. In a new test, McGaw's team asked the wizards, as well as non-wizards like me, to go back day by day to see how much we remember.
So yesterday I went to the gym.
For breakfast, I had pineapple and some papaya.
I remember waking up at 9:22, actually.
I remember exactly what I had for lunch. I remember, I could tell you in rich detail.
In memory of what happened yesterday, we are as good as they are. That surprised me.
Yeah.
But we have pretty good memories of yesterday. A couple days later, we're almost as good as they are.
And I remember Sunday quite well.
And then at 10 o'clock, I had a banana.
I really had to go to the bathroom, so we had to stop like 4
But their rate of forgetting is very small, and ours is large. So by the time we get to a week, we're very different in our memories. And we get to a month, and they are still almost as good as they were a week afterwards, and we've gone to almost zero. Wow. They are not exceptional learners. They are very poor forgetters.
I was definitely a strong forgetter. I couldn't remember anything when I got to the end of the previous week.
Thursday and Friday. Wow.
But is it really that we forget? Watch what happened after my test when my 60 Minutes colleagues reminded me that the Thursday and Friday I'd been struggling with, we had been together shooting a story.
Thursday and Friday? When I was prompted, then I remembered in great detail. I just couldn't bring it up.
Well, you have arrived at what we think is the most critical issue in this research. Do they have in their brains retrieval mechanisms for memory that we don't have? Now, if that's the case, that would suggest the possibility that we have all those memories. We're just like them. We don't have the hooks to get the memories out. Wouldn't that be interesting? If that were the case, the possibility would be that we could do something which would make those memories come out better. Wouldn't that be exciting?
But that raises an important question. Would we really want to remember it all?
What is the hardest part of having this kind of memory?
The worst thing is that I can remember every bad thing that happened to me.
You remember every bad thing?
I remember this from The Lion King. Leave the past behind.
You hear that?
But
all
I can't
the time.
Do that.
But do you think you have to learn how to make it fade?
It's probably going to be hard
to let it go.
Because I can't forget it.
We were in New Jersey this summer on vacation, and he woke up one day and he said, this was a really bad day last year because you yelled at me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, as a father, you go, God, geez, honey, I don't even remember. What did I say?
He said it's a bad day.
Breaks your heart.
I think for us, time heals, or at least lessens it. And I feel that for them, it probably doesn't.
I can't let it fade because I just have that type of memory that can remember everything.
We thought it might help Jake to meet some other people with that type of memory.
Cute! Look at you! Oh my gosh, are you darling?
So we brought him together with Louise Owen, Bob Petrella, and Mary Lou Henner. To break the ice, Bob asked Jake about sports.
So October 27th, 2011.
October 27th.
Think about it. If you're a Cardinal fan.
Game six. That's get it up, baby. Get it up, yeah. Baby.
Who hit the key hit? Remember?
Dave Freese.
That's it. Yeah.
Center field.
All right. He's validated.
Okay.
It was like a super memory summit.
Is it as if you're living it again as opposed to, for me, kind of a two-dimensional memory?
For me, it is. I mean, you say the date, and I'm there as though it happened moments ago rather than 28 years ago.
And that is both emotionally and smelling and touching.
It really feels like time travel. Like
it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah. You, right there. You can almost feel the clothes
yes.
you were wearing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You
know,
they
can
do
that.
Know, just all
yeah.
the
do you think it's sad that the rest of us lose so much memory of our own lives? Feel sorry for us.
I do.
You do?
I do.
Louise said she feels her memory is a gift, and she had some encouragement for the newest member of the Memory Club.
I think it's like having a superpower. And, you know, you can be normal. You can be
superior.
Yeah, you can be Clark Kent. You can sort of blend in with everybody else. But then when you really need to fly, you can totally fly, and it's awesome.
On balance, taking your life, are you glad you have this memory or you wish you didn't have this memory?
I'm glad.
You're glad, on balance.
Yeah.
After our story aired, Dr. McGaw and his team heard from dozens of parents who suspect their children have this type of memory too. And Mary Lou Henner is working as a consultant on the CBS drama Unforgettable, about a detective who uses her Henner-like memory to solve crimes.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
So I was recently looking to buy a new car, and I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. And that's when a friend of mine told me about this new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car that you're looking at in your area, so you know if you're getting a good price. Because here's what happens. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer. You can't beat it. Save time, save money, never overpay. If you're going to buy a car, go to TrueCar.com today.
Beauty has a way of turning up in places where you'd least expect it. We went to the Democratic Republic of Congo 2 years ago, the poorest country in the world. Kinshasa, the capital, has a population of 10 million and almost nothing in the way of hope or peace. Until recently, there was a well-kept secret down there, a symphony orchestra, the only one in Central Africa, the only all-black one in the world. It's called the Kimbangist Symphony Orchestra. We'd never heard of it. No one we called had ever heard of it. But when we got there, we were surprised to find 200 musicians and vocalists who'd never played outside Kinshasa or had been outside Kinshasa. We were even more surprised to find joy in the Congo. When we told the musicians they would be on 60 Minutes, they didn't know what we were talking about. But still, they invited us to a performance. And tonight, we thought it would be good to hear them again.
We caught up with them as they were preparing outside their concert hall, a rented warehouse. As curtain time neared, we had no idea what to expect, but Maestro Armand Yengyenda seemed confident and began the evening with a bang. Carmina Burana was written by German composer Karl Orff 75 years ago. Did he ever dream that it would be played in the Congo? It wouldn't have been if it hadn't been for Armand and a strange twist of fate. Armand was a commercial pilot until 20 years ago when his airline went bust. So, like ex-pilots often do, he decided to put together an orchestra. He was just missing a few things.
You had no musicians, you had no teachers, you had no instruments, and you had no one who knew how to read music.
No, nobody.
Armand's English is limited. He preferred speaking French, Congo's official language.
When you started asking people if they wanted to be members of this orchestra, did they have any idea what you were talking about?
In the beginning, he said, people made fun of us, saying here in the Congo, classical music puts people to sleep. But Armand pressed on. He taught himself how to read music and play the piano, play the trombone, the guitar, and the cello. He talked a few members of his church into joining him. They brought their friends, which brought more problems. We only had five or six violins, he said, for the 12 people who wanted to learn how to play the violin. So they took turns, he said. One would play for 15 or 20 minutes at a time. That was very difficult. But more instruments started coming in. Some were donated, others rescued from local thrift shops in various states of disrepair. Then it was up to Albert, the orchestra surgeon, to heal them. He wasn't always gentle with his patients, but they survived. Armand told us that when a violin string broke in those early days, they used whatever they had at hand to fix it.
He took the wire from a bicycle.
Bicycle, yes.
The brake of a bicycle, and turned it into a string for a violin.
Yes.
And it played music.
Right.
And with every functioning instrument, more would-be musicians poured in. Before long, Armand's house became a makeshift conservatory. Armand was the dean. Every room, every corridor, no matter how small or dark or stifling, was teeming with sound. Outdoors, the parking lot was a quiet spot to practice the viola. But even this was an oasis compared to what was on the other side of the walls. The Congo is, after all, a war-torn country, has been for 60 years. This is where most of the musicians live, on unpaved streets, with little in the way of running water, electricity, or sanitation. The musicians don't get paid for playing in the orchestra. Some work in the market, selling whatever they can. Very few people in Kinshasa make more than $50 a month or live past 50. Sylvie Mbella's life has gotten even more demanding since she started in the orchestra 17 years ago. She's got three kids now. There are no daycare centers in the neighborhood, so the kids are always with her, never far from her fiddle. But when she turns from mother to musician, she says she has left this planet. She's not in the Congo anymore. For years, Sylvie and the orchestra played on, but only in Kinshasa. No one outside the Congo knew anything about them until 2010. That's when two German filmmakers made a documentary which was shown in Germany. It so inspired musicians in Germany, they sent out instruments and then themselves to give master classes. Opera vocalists Rolf Schmitz-Malberg and Sabine Kalhammer came to teach technique and diction. And if you ever question that music is the universal language, watch this. A German-speaking teacher tutoring a French-speaking African how to sing an aria in Italian. But when Rolf and Sabine moved on to the full choir, it wasn't so easy.
Were they pleased to see you? Do you think that they said, oh, how wonderful we have two white people here to teach us how to play music?
They had experiences with other white people, so I can really understand that they were careful and a little shy, but they really were open to learn.
At times they weren't sure what they were learning or why. What was this all about? The exercises are designed to loosen you up, the Germans explained, and after a while, they did.
And then they started to sing for us, and then we were like, oh. Their faces change when they do their music. I mean, if you live in Kinshasa, there is no cultural life here. So these people have to find a way to go to some other places. Making music is one way to go on a trip, a cheap trip, because you can just close your eyes. They do that very often, and they are somewhere else.
Bien, bravo, bravo.
Merci beaucoup. Diesen Kuss hier.
Rolf moved on to the next class. That's where we met two tenors, brothers Karim and Valvi Belolo. They live in the countryside, 10 miles from Armand's place. They took us there.
Ma fille?
Oui. The boy's parents, two brothers and a sister, share a three-room blockhouse. Karim and Valvi certainly had to learn the importance of harmony growing up here, so by the time they met Armand, harmony was second nature. When did you join the orchestra?
En 2003.
November.
Le 8 novembre 2003.
The 8th of November in 2003.
Yes.
Why do you think you remember the exact date?
Bon, c'est la naissance, hein?
Well, he said, it's like a birth for us in this symphony orchestra, so it's a date we can't forget. And this is how they get to rehearsal. 6 days a week, 90 minutes each way. Some would call it a trek. For them, it's a commute. When they get downtown, the last stretch is on a bus. What keeps them going? The music. Always the music.
They come here every day, they sing, and they go home. It's really amazing.
Pretty difficult to relate to that, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that anybody would do that with these conditions in our country, no.
The boys and the choir have quite a repertoire now. Bach, Mendelssohn, Handel, and of course, Beethoven. The week we were there, the orchestra was rehearsing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Not exactly starter music, but Armand was determined to take it on. And like a good general, he reviewed all his troops. The choir? Okay. The strings? Not bad. But the full orchestra? Not quite. French horns, he said, you're hitting it too hard. Be mindful of the echo, he told the string section. Finally, it all came together. And on the night of the performance, in this rented warehouse, Beethoven came alive. Called the Ode to Joy, the last movement of Beethoven's last symphony. It has been played with more expertise before, but with more joy, hard to imagine. In the last 2 years since we first broadcast this story, the orchestra has been invited to perform in some major cities, including Berlin, Monte Carlo, and Los Angeles. The story is also sad for us. The wonderful man who co-produced it, Clem Taylor, died a month ago.
In the mail this week, comments on our story about Pope Francis and his impact on and beyond the Catholic Church. The first one from a nun. I found it uplifting and informative. It showed a human side of a man who was chosen for the highest position in the church and yet is being true to himself. But some writers weren't pleased at all. Why do you promote religion? We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes. Tomorrow, be sure to watch CBS This Morning, and I'll see you on the CBS Evening News.